the most distressing episode of this entire thing for me was the third night, heading into the fourth day, fourth night, I guess. And I was lying in bed just going, I have leukemia. I know it. It's because I'm negative. I don't have COVID. If this isn't COVID, what is it? And that's why doctors should never take care of themselves.
Hey, folks, that was Dr. Drew, who has COVID and talking about the first couple of days of having COVID and how freaked out he was. Obviously, it's not a laughing matter. I had COVID. We're both long haulers. And so that's what we're talking about on this episode is how we're dealing with it. Hope you find it interesting or helpful. I think it's good for people to hear whether you have it or not. You may know somebody who has it, but we get into a lot of different aspects of it. And after I do this, I got to go get my wife a Valentine's Day gift because it's Valentine's Day and I completely spaced it. It's Valentine's Day. So I'm going to the market, get some flowers that'll probably die in about 2 days, and I'll get her some candy. I don't know where. Oh, I can get her candy at the checkout. I'll get her like a Hershey bar. Yeah. I'm probably getting divorced soon, but, you know, I'm doing my best. All right. Enjoy this episode. I think there's a lot in there, and we have fun doing it, so hopefully you'll find it a little entertaining as well. All right. Thanks, guys. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. On with me is my good friend, co-COVID sufferer, Dr. Drew from California.
Co-long hauler, baby. Although you're ahead of me, you're technically chronic COVID. I'm still a long hauler.
You're a rookie. We're going to bring you along, show you how to complain properly, you know, elicit sympathy from people. Oh, I can't help you with the dishes. I'm tired from COVID.
What's phenomenal is already everyone's sick of me and tired of it and angry, you know, because you look like you can get on with your life, but you feel like you can't do anything.
And then your dog is sitting there like, hey, it's great having him home. And then it's like, why is he home a lot? And then the third phase is, man, this person's annoying. Could you get out of the house?
But the problem is you end up being that way to everybody, including yourself. Yeah.
I know. So do you have a sense of where you might have gotten this? I mean, mine was in Florida performing in a club when they weren't making people wear masks at the table. That's where I got it.
I have no overt exposure like that. Nothing. I wore the mask exactly as I was supposed to. People point at some of the things I did 2 months before and say, that's how you got it, which is of course impossible.
Right.
The only thing different I did that week where I got it was I was running around the hospital trying to get the vaccine. And everyone goes, oh no, you couldn't have gotten it there. I'm like, my wife's convinced I got it there.
I don't mean to laugh, but that's pretty ironic if you ran around to get the vaccine and you got COVID.
Ironic and the real comedy was I had an appointment. I came in and they start yelling at me. Your papers, where are your papers? It was like a scene from a World War II border crossing. It was crazy. And it got confusing to me. The thought bubble over my head was, do you enjoy talking to senior staff like this? Is this like making you feel weird?
You're on staff there too. Oh my God.
Oh, it was so weird. It was just like, wow. So then I started running around all these poorly ventilated hospitals trying to find where I'm supposed to go and what I'm supposed to do.
But wait, what are the papers for? And why couldn't you just get it at your hospital? You're a staff person and you're on the front line. Like, what was?
I wasn't on the front line at the hospital. I was on the front line in the outpatient setting, which was a different category. And in California, they took the position that they had to vaccine everybody associated with a hospital, the gardeners, the window washers, everybody had to get the vaccine before anybody else. So there you go. And so I happily fell in line. I went, okay, well, what are we doing here? And then I volunteered to work in the ER. I was like, well, they need help. They claim they're short staffed. I'll volunteer. Talk to the woman who heads it up. She was excited. She thought I should get vaccinated first. I wasn't doing it to get the vaccine. 3 days later, I'm sick. Mm-hmm. And now I couldn't tolerate an hour working in the ER. I couldn't do it.
My COVID doctor in New York has it and had it. And she said the same thing. And she said, I'm working all day. I go home and I just curl up in a ball, go to sleep. I'm just exhausted all the time. Yeah. And so you had more, it's pronounced symptoms from it at the beginning than I did. I had a little bit of a cough and then I said, uh-oh, I just came back from being with these yahoos in Florida. Let me go get checked out. And 3 days later, I tested positive. And, but when we talked on the phone a couple of weeks ago, you were coughing and wheezing. And what's some of the stuff that you've been dealing with?
Oh, Jesus. The main thing I feel like I've had a traumatic brain injury. That's the best. I'm ringing my ears. I have balance problems. I have motor problems. Can't think. I'm having personality changes. It's pretty crazy. Irritable.
Wow. You're having your period. That's what you're having.
It could be that. Maybe that at least will pass. And, then I had a bad cough and shortness of breath and all that kind of stuff. And I was really sick for about 2 weeks. I couldn't get out of bed. I mean, no way. And got some good treatment and stayed out of the hospital. And that was my goal. So I didn't want to take a hospital bed.
Well, this is a perfect example of, two healthy guys, especially you. You work out a lot. You're incredibly healthy. And it hits you like a ton of bricks. It didn't hit me like a ton of bricks, but I'm 7 months in and I'm long hauling this thing and dealing with. Did you get, when you got hit with it, were you surprised? I mean, obviously, what were your thoughts before you got it? Did your thoughts about it change after you got it? Like, how did that all play?
I learned about the flu part, which is the original, what you get at first, you get like the flu. And the flu part was less bad than H1N1, which I had also had 10 years before. And that was way worse. That really kicked the shit out of me. But what follows the flu was bad with COVID. What followed was this inflammatory thing where I got more cough and I couldn't breathe and I was more weak and I was more out of it neurologically. And that was relentless. Like every day was the same. And so my doctor and I were sort of working on, all kinds of treatments, dexamethasone and bamlanivimab and things to try to get ahead of this thing. But I definitely had what I learned was, my thought at the time was, hey, if we don't stay ahead of this, it can really go. I see how this can get bad.
So when you say stay ahead for people listening and watching, so what does that mean? Are you loading yourself up with antibodies? Like what are those drugs?
No, I'm taking treatment. I'm taking steroids. I'm taking monoclonal antibodies. I took some ivermectin and I took some antibiotics later. I mean, we were treating this thing aggressively and it worked.
But I thought you weren't supposed to. I thought steroids my doctor said, no to those because they suppress the immune system, or does it not? Since you were very early on, they can work, but then once you've had it, it doesn't work.
There's different ways of approaching it. Some people would say only for the, originally it was just for the ICU patients. Then they started seeing benefit used earlier. And I'm completely convinced that early aggressive treatment is the way to deal with this thing. Yeah. So the steroids, as soon as I got on them, helped. I stopped progressing. Then when I got the bamlanivimab, I actually got better. That actually made me feel better.
And what does that drug do? What is that?
It's a monoclonal antibody. It's like the vaccine. It's like an exogenous antibody. Instead of your body creating the antibody like a vaccine, they construct the antibody and give it to you. Or it's like convalescent plasma.
How long does that antibody last? Like, is that a daily pill you have to take?
It's an IV infusion. You have to sign up for an infusion. Nurse shows up and infuses you and that's it.
Wow. And how long...
And it's available the government bought 800,000 doses and it's available to everyone. It's covered by everything, Medicaid, Medi-Cal, everything. Mm. And doctors aren't prescribing it because they're just not, because there's an interesting thing that happened here. Because usually when the drug companies make a new drug, they market it to the doctors, and they market it to the public. The government bought this stuff and it just put it on a shelf and didn't really do a good job of educating doctors what it is and how to get it. So you have to go to the Health and Human Services website to even find out what's going on locally for you.
Would it help me or other people that are watching or listening who are long haulers, or is it too far past the point of
helping? It's not available for long haulers. It has to be within the first 10 days of illness.
And why is that?
It's still emergency use authorization. It's very limited use authorization. It's not widely approved yet.
Is it because it's a toxic? Is it because it's a potential to be damaging? They don't know.
I mean, they have to study it more. I mean, when you rush things to an EUA, you're not done studying it. You're just pushing it out there as fast as you can for very specific use. But I'll tell you, there are some long hauler things going on. I just wrote a note to my doctor and said, what about colchicine or fluvoxamine? Should I think about getting on one of these things? Colchicine especially is very intriguing. It's just it's a nothing anti-inflammatory drug. And some people are having good results with that.
And I have inflammation of my joints, especially my elbows. I've been going to physical therapy for it. This finger every morning, stiff as a board.
And I have a cold sore on my lip.
Well, but that's the thing. Like,
when you
go to your doctor with this, like, I think the thing that's frustrating and a little scary is the response. Like, you go in and you go, and I, you know, you give the litany. In my case, I don't know. Have you had shooting pains at different parts of your body, just like these zapping pains? Yeah, have you?
I had something this morning that made me think of you. What was it? My shoulder started bugging me. And I thought, Imperio.
Exactly. So I said, you know, I get these shooting pains. And she's like, yeah, we've heard that. They described it like, you know, plugging an electric shock and plugging something and getting a shock. The no taste, no smell. Yeah. Fatigue. Yeah. But you literally could say anything like every Tuesday, frogs crawl out of my ass. Yes, we've heard that.
Again, I think we should be more aggressive.
Well, I want to talk about that. But I want to get to that because, but I want to tell us, like, so I said, why is this happening? And she just looks at me and goes, we don't know. And that's the part that first freaked me out, scared me, now just frustrates me. I called her last week and I said, look, is there a pill yet for just being tired? Because I can't stand this being tired. I have no stamina. I do like, went sweating with some friends, like a little hill, like a, not this, like this. I walk up the hill, I go down the hill. I had to sit down.
Yeah. It was like
where's my Jello in stories? Like, yeah. It was just like, but you and I talked about the approaches in America to this versus in other countries.
It's weird. It's been politicized.
It's interesting.
It's been politicized. It is steeped in orthodoxy and doctors. I'm trying to figure out what happened to my profession. It's really interesting. I was trained to improvise and use currently available wisdom to do the best for the patient. Don't worry about orthodoxy. Don't worry about just evidence-based material, because if the evidence base hasn't caught up yet, you have to do things. You have to use your best judgment to try to make some good interventions, even though the evidence isn't there yet. As soon as it's there, you adjust to what the evidence is, but you familiarize yourself with what evidence is available and you make a good judgment of what you think might work for the patient. You don't do nothing and say, well, sorry, we're going to have to wait till the science catches up. My God, that's the weirdest thing in the world. But I'm
finding...
Interesting. I found that every surgeon I talked to, the surgeons who are used to improvising when there's a problem in the surgical field, something starts bleeding, they improvise. Right. They immediately started using all kinds of things. They used it on their family, their patients, everybody.
Give me that T-shirt. We got a bleeder. Give me a T-shirt. Give me the sponge from the kitchen.
Surgeons were like, I got it. Here's the literature. I'd send them articles. And they go, I see it. Got it. I'm using it. I'm like, okay. But my internist friends, like myself, general medicine doctors, I have discovered that most of them are now working for large corporations and hospitals and schools, and they're afraid to do anything. They're being controlled by these entities that are saying, no, there's too much risk, or wait till the science isn't there yet. Dr. Smith hasn't set the standard yet. In the meantime, you just stand by, sit on your hands while patients die. That's crazy to me.
Is it because they were concerned about litigation? It's defensive.
I don't know.
Defensive medicine.
I don't know. It's I don't think it's just defensive medicine. I think it's fear of canceling and losing your job. If you do something that isn't orthodoxy, you're a Trump. You're Trump supporter.
My father-in-law. You're right. My father-in-law was an OBGYN, and he, you know. He'd be in his 90s now. So, you know, he was practicing the day when, you know, he had his own practice. His father and his mother were OBGYNs, my wife's grandparents. And his mother was like one of the first OBGYNs in the country. And later in his practice, he just got more and more discouraged because he felt like the insurance company started to kind of control.
Oh, yeah, that was for sure.
You know, having to order tests. And then he said, you know, watch, he had foresight. He goes, these HMOs that start forming, these are corporations, and it was just in the nascent stages. And he said, they're going to have a big influence on medicine because at the end of the day, the doctor's an employee of a company and he's going to have to listen to a guy in a suit.
That's exactly what's happening. And they're not fear. And I don't think the hospitals are so much fearful of litigation because we've been living in that environment with the insurances and the litigators for 30 years. I mean, that's just part of the world we live in. This right. is something new. This is something new where doctors are afraid to speak up and say anything if they have an opinion that's outside of immediate orthodoxy. Normally, we would share ideas and come to a consensus, or or we try to convince each other of our position and why, and we'd share and come to, you know, sort of good judgments for the patient. Now people are afraid even to speak something that isn't orthodoxy. So, fluvoxamine, for instance, the original study was funded by a guy in Silicon Valley who was looking just for some way to support, he was stuck home and had some money. He was trying to do something. And he went to, Berkeley, Stanford and all these big institutions, says, how do we find a new medication, a new treatment? And the very smart researcher said, well, first thing, find a medicine we're already using and see if you can repurpose it.
Oh, because then you don't have to get the pre-approval.
And it's FDA also, we know it's safe. We know what it is. We know how it goes. It's all, you can just try to use it. Right. And he came upon fluvoxamine, which is also called Luvox. It's an antidepressant medicine that it turns out has effects on an inflammatory mediator in the brain called sigma-1. It's just an incidental property of the Luvox. And it seems to really have a marked effect on this syndrome. So I keep thinking I might take it. I keep asking my doctor if he wants to give it to me. Colchicine is another one. Colchicine is a medicine that's been around since probably the 50s. It's used for gout and some rheumatic diseases. People are saying it's working for that. Why not try it? The only downside of colchicine is diarrhea if you take too much. So, and yet doctors are afraid even to speak these things for being seen as somehow lining up with alternative people or some of the stuff that was silenced and squashed during the
Is there competition involved
It's
not that.
It's all it feels political. It feels strangely political. It's very strange. And so now when I hearken back to when we first talk about this thing and I was so upset about what the press was saying and the way this thing was going.
Yeah, we did that on Sirius Radio,
Yeah, this was the stuff I saw coming. I saw panic, which was only going to make things worse. I saw press mandating treatment and people outside of medicine mandating interventions that they don't know anything about. It was driving me crazy. And then the policies of the Chinese Communist government, which they invented, this whole idea of lockdown and distancing, these aren't in infectious disease textbooks. These were invented this outbreak. They just were deployed, and that the press and the government were contemplating using a policy that was established by a dictatorship or by a totalitarian government when I think back, it's like no wonder I was upset.
And I just
wanted people to calm down and listen to Dr. Fauci. Just listen to the CDC.
Right, and you did say that. You did say that,
and I still say it.
And I tell you, Dr. Birx, wow. Just now she's on a rehabilitation of her image tour where she just did Face the Nation. And, I was railing on her on 60 Minutes on Twitter, actually, before she sat there and Trump said inject bleach and she didn't do anything, because it was clear that she was a political animal in the way she was behaving and a sycophant and cared more about that. Now, you may know her and she might be a friend. I'm sorry, but I thought she did a really poor job. And Fauci, ultimately, even the CDC director, Redfield, he was kind of really a sycophant, came around a little bit toward the end of his term. But Fauci was the only one I could.
But yeah, I agree. Fauci was the only one that sort of quasi stood up. But you got to remember, they serve at the, at the pleasure of a president. That's their job. Now, how is that different than my peers?
No. But wait a minute.
Hang on.
Yeah.
How are different than my peers that are unwilling to speak up and they're being sycophantic to their systems and their bosses and all that stuff? Yeah. It's the same. It's pervasive right now. It's crazy making. Now, I thank God Fauci seems to be stepping forward and being a little clearer, right?
Yeah.
He's a little more assertive now, and now you can really hear what he wants to say.
But he was able to, but they were literally side by side, he and Birx. I mean, literally, metaphorically. And he was able to continue to keep the trust of us, I think.
Us. No, people and hate same, when I
and negotiate you, that.
You and me. But when I mention his name, people go crazy. They hate him. They think he's a liar and he's a this and a that, merely because he had an opinion about masks before we understood more fully how this thing was transmitted.
Yeah.
and he updated his priors and adjusted to recommending masks. I mean, what are scientists supposed to do? They're liars if they get something wrong before
information. No, that's what I mean. But I found Birx saying, she contradicted herself and admitted it in this interview, because they have a clip of her saying, the president's really ingesting all of this information. This is during the throes of it. And he really has a handle on it. And he had no handle on it. He didn't care. And then she said she was asked, when you would give him a briefing, would he read it? And she went, I don't know. I'm not just beating her up, but like, there are, if you're going to take a position of leadership, you have to own everything that comes with that, you know? And I just felt like my other thing. And I said this, I was doing a co-hosted Neil deGrasse Tyson show with him, Star Talk. And we were talking to, Paul Offit. And I said, why don't Fauci and Birx resign so that they're completely unfettered by this president and go do their thing? And they have all sorts of public ways to, you know, Twitter, social media.
No, I don't think you get how the CDC works. Yeah. They would have no effect, and somebody would step into their job in the CDC and they would then represent the CDC, and that would be that. And it would be someone worse. Trust me.
Now that you talked about comparing, when we talked on the phone a while back, what we're doing in America in terms of the approach of the medicine, but to then Europe and other countries are more apt to improvise, as you say, and adapt, try and be more aggressive. And why is that? Aren't there corporations there?
It feels like that it became so political during the initial phases of this thing that people develop these very strange defensive positions around doing anything other than orthodoxy.
Yeah.
It was it's very strange. It's loosened up now. Now that Trump's out, people are starting to chat and talk.
Right.
I mean, it literally is, now that he's gone, okay, now we can have some conversation, but still, they're very slow. This is how we started this conversation. Your doctor's not willing to try stuff.
Yeah,
they're waiting for some definitive science, which, great. In the meantime, Paul and Drew suffer.
Is it because it's less political? It's a really great point you make. If you take a combination of the corporate structure and then you layer over politicalization of this thing, it creates this bottleneck. And you think in Europe, let's just use Europe as an example, that there's less of the politics around this and they're all accepting that this is real and you got to deal.
They're leaving it in the hands of the medical system. They're letting the doctors and the medical organizations tell them what to do, and then they do it. Right. I mean, that's what other thing I kept saying. I kept listening to the CDC. Did the CDC ever say close schools? No. Mm. Did the CDC ever say shelter in place? Oh my God, no. Because those things make things worse, at least not better, and maybe worse.
You didn't think those two things at any point in the pandemic have been a good idea? Closing schools or?
The closing schools in regions might have been helpful. But closing schools, it's so weird. We pick and choose where we stay with the evidence. There's no evidence that school closure has been effective. And there's some good evidence that lockdowns make things worse, which is why the World Health Organization has taken the position that under no circumstances should lockdowns be recommended again. That's the World Health Organization.
But in a lockdown, it's counterintuitive. You're supposed to be more isolated. You're not interacting in public.
Where is all the transmission? Where does all the transmission for COVID really develop? Where is it?
I think
90% of it.
Taking it into their home?
Yeah, it's in the home. 90% of transmission is in the home.
Right,
if you go to the grocery store, which you're allowed to do in a lockdown, somebody's going to bring it home. It's going to go through the whole family. I mean, there's no such thing as a lockdown where no one ever leaves the house.
It's called a Peapod lockdown. It's the places that they deliver food. They control the whole thing and make billions of dollars. No, I'm just kidding. So I see what you're saying. The lockdown is not a pure lockdown. And so I'm hearing more now that evidence that, and you probably were hearing it a lot sooner because this is your field, but that there's the evidence that there is no significant transmission of this in schools. And so it warrants. I mean, you still have to distance the kids and everything, right? And the masks.
I mean, you want to be. You listen. We're going for zero transmission, right? We're going for extremely safe. And so, yeah, you have to. And you have to make sure the teachers all get vaccinated. And you have to do all those good things. Right. Absolutely. But when you do all that, the transmission rate, as compared to the developmental trajectory problems we're going to have, the mental health crisis we're in, you don't see kids for COVID right now. You see them for depression and suicide. That's what's happening. It's unbelievable. Yeah. The tidal wave of mental health problems in young adults and children and adolescents. It's out of control.
So the suicides among young adults or teenagers, was it already sort of potentially there beneath the surface? And what exacerbates it about this? Just the lack of social contact with other people their age?
I just want you to please put this in. Think about this. You're 14 and you're being told there's no future. The world's coming to an end. Your family's in jeopardy. You've got to stay in your home. And God forbid, you cannot go out and see your peers. You can't go outside and play. You can't go to school and develop and focus on. I mean, it's just the worst possible thing you could do for this age group, and they get depressed.
Yeah,
I mean, they don't have a perspective. They can't say, "Oh, it's going to end. My family's going to be fine." They turn on the TV. Two more dead. It's like, oh my God. You know, as Adam said, when we were adolescents, the Hillside Strangler was loose in Los Angeles. And it was always on the news every night. And so he and I went to bed every night in 1972, figuring he's coming in our house tonight. This is probably it. Here it comes.
You know, right. I mean, right.
That's how adolescents and children think. Right. They're very grandiose. They don't have a judgment about this.
Right.
And so it's horrific for them. It's really, really bad. What did I want to say about that?
Well, the thing in Europe used to go back. Are they using, I have this too. This is part of the brain. I was telling you this on the phone. This is exactly what happened to you. It's been happening to me every once in a while. You're in a conversation with somebody, you're talking about the thing, the other person is talking. But you're saying, okay, when he's done talking, I got this other thing I want to say, he's done. And then you're like,
gone. Yeah. Gone. Not there. Yeah.
Gone.
So it was something to do with school. Oh, I know what I want to tell you, which was, do you know where the idea of lockdown came from? It has a history.
The Germans in World War II locking down. Countries.
I think she was 14. She might have been 16. A 16-year-old high school student in the early 2000s. When was the first George Bush in office?
2000. Oh, the first one was it Reagan 84.
Okay, so it's the second George Bush. So early 2000s. Early 2000s, a high school student put together a high school science project in the early 2000s. I think it was 2003. And the science project was a model, not any kind of scientific experiment. It was a computer model that suggested that you could help influenza outbreaks, which is transmitted by children and transmitted differently than coronavirus, that you could have an effect on influenza outbreak by having local school shutdowns. Her father, who was a computer programmer at the Los Alamos laboratory, said, "That's a great idea. I bet I can build a computer model about lockdowns and local lockdowns, not national lockdowns, and pandemics." She published an article in 2004. The high school student was the second lead author on the paper, and the Bush administration adopted it as pandemic policy. It never was applied. It was never, medicine never adopted it. Infectious disease, epidemiology never really codified it. It was just sort of a theoretical model that was put out there as one of the things that could be used in a pandemic. It wasn't lockdown. It wasn't shelter in place. It was localized lockdowns. Right. And that magically turned into this, whatever it is we're doing.
Yeah. Now in Europe, are they experimenting with any medicines? Because I'll fly over there right now. I will stay in a hostel. I don't care. Are they experimenting with anything?
Countries are using ivermectin for long haulers. But I mean, I'm hearing people using colchicine and fluvoxamine here. I mean, you could talk to your doctors about those too. Now you go.
What is ivermectin?
Ivermectin is a it's a worm medicine that has a lot of antiviral activity, right. And people are using it early. Like India, they're handing it out all over the place apparently, and then they're talking about. So there's a guy named Dr. Yogendra, who I had you talk to, who has been trying it with some of the long haul. You could talk to him about the long hauler stuff.
Oh, right? Yeah.
He'll prescribe.
So for people listening or watching, it was so funny because to do this, there's different studies going on. I'm part of a Mount Sinai study and I gave blood to that. And then Drew was nice enough to introduce me to doctors and researchers doing something. And I had to get them blood and they had to send me the vials of the blood. And then I had to call somebody to take the blood. And I felt like, I don't know, I felt like I was doing something illegal and like, I'll meet you behind the 7-Eleven. I've got five vials. That is five vials I need you to fill. So I had to get five vials filled, this nurse friend of mine. Then we had to pack them and they don't make the little styrofoam things. They're hard to find. So we had to buy a big beach styrofoam cooler. And my wife and I cut it down to tip. And then we start yelling at each other. It's like, it doesn't need a cover that big. and it's like, you know what? I'd rather die of COVID. This is not worth it. So we ship the blood out and it's with the researcher, Bruce Patterson, one of them. So there's this theory of cytokine storm.
Yeah.
Explain to people what that is and to me too, because I kind of understand it, but I don't.
So one, it's in the back. And then one of the features of this coronavirus is you get the flu, and then that's followed by inflammation. And the inflammation is mediated by activation of what's called the cytokine system. Cytokines are essentially the communication chemicals that draw inflammatory cells in and regulate and mediate inflammation. Some of them can actually have direct tissue effects. But this syndrome, this system of cytokines goes out of control during COVID and during long hauler, we think. And I've noticed recently they're actually using interferon, I think, as a treatment. They might use it for long haulers too. The interferon, I think, just got approved today. And interferon is, again, one of these chemical messengers that's out there in the blood that gets imbalanced by COVID.
So when there's this imbalance or cytokine storm, what is the manifestation of that? Is that part of the cause of my inflammation? I've got inflamed elbows that I'm having to get therapy for because I can't even barely lift a coffee cup. Is that what happens?
Dr. Patterson thinks that's a lot of it. There's also a theory about mast cell activation. There's a lot of theories flying around.
Right.
People are advocating using quercetin, a lot of quercetin every day to try to block mast cell inflammatory mediation. And that's another interesting idea that's out there.
Yeah.
But nobody really knows. Bottom line, that's why when you ask your doctor what, we don't know. Because that's true. Yeah. We don't know yet. Yeah. We're trying to figure it out.
And I'm taking per doctor's orders. Basically, the only thing I'm taking that I can take is vitamins. I'm taking zinc, vitamin D. She just added a couple of others to my turmeric. And really the thing is helping is a physical therapy, but you don't know. The thing is that you and I don't know, is this going to come back in some form or sort of lead to something else later? And that worries me. Does that worry you?
I think about that once in a while, because whenever I start feeling shitty, I think, oh my God, could this thing come back? Doesn't really seem to come back. It doesn't really seem to do that. But we don't know. I mean, we're going to get dementia in 10 years or something. I mean, who knows? If that happens from traumatic brain injury, this feels like traumatic brain injury. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's out of our hands, whatever it's going to be.
Now, why does a healthy guy like you get hit so hard or somebody like me and somebody who's not healthy doesn't get hit hard? It's all over the place. Do you have any sense of that and why?
Clearly genetic. They've isolated six genes that are associated with I think resistance or maybe more severe disease. But the point is there's a lot of different differences amongst people. I always get slammed by viruses. I had mononucleosis when I was in high school. I was sick for a month. I had H1N1 10 years ago. I thought I was going to die. It was the worst thing ever. So I get these things and I get just obliterated by them. My wife never gets obliterated by them, never gets even sick that way ever. She was lying next to me the entire night during my first night of fever. Nothing.
That's amazing that she was lying next to you. My wife was like, "Are you go in another state? I don't want you around."
Well, I didn't know. It was Christmas Eve. I went to bed. I had kind of a fitful night, and she felt me in the morning. She goes, "Oh my God, you're on fire!" And I was like, "Oh, yeah, sure enough."
That's counterintuitive. I mean, you're around. You would think you have an immune system like an ox. Like you're around. You've been around sick people in hospitals your whole life. You would think it's the reverse, and your wife would be the one that's all DNA. Is that the explanation for that?
I think it's genetic. Yeah, it's genetic.
So they think that there's this. What was explained to me is they have me doing these stasis breathing exercises, where you breathe in through the nose into your diaphragm and breathe out, because they want to activate the parasympathetic part of your nervous system. Because what my doctor said to me is there's the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. Because I said, why am I so tired all the time? So she said, the sympathetic is it kicks in fight or flight mode, right? So the virus comes in, it starts, and it's just overworking. It's over and overcharged. And you need to balance that. Otherwise, you're going to continue to be exhausted all the time. And the way you balance it is to activate the parasympathetic and the nerve endings in the lower part of the lungs in particular through these deep breathing exercises.
So you do your Wim Hof breathing. You know what Wim Hof is?
I can see already you think it's bullshit.
No, I don't think it's necessarily bullshit, because Wim Hof has a lot of interesting disciples.
No, I don't know what that is. What is it?
He's a guy that has a breathing technique. You can to hold your breath for a lot longer, and he swims under like ice caps and things. He swims in, you know, literally frozen water every day. And he's an interesting fellow.
Yeah.
And there's something called hormesis, where somehow the cold will challenge your immune system. And this is all that same kind of thinking about the parasympathetic system and all. I'm actually a big believer in the vagus nerve's effect on our health. So that makes some sense. So how long do you do the breathing for? I should adopt this.
I could send you the protocol. You start off doing 10 minutes in the morning, and then 10 minutes at night, and then you build that up to 20 minutes, and then you go to the third phase. Is you breathe in, hold it for 6 seconds, breathe out through the nose, hold that for 6 seconds, and breathe in. And so And
so I have a problem.
I don't know if it's helping, though.
My nose is congested all the time.
So Jesus.
Yeah. And I do notice that my heart rate is up a bit.
So is that right?
That's consistent with that theory, yeah.
Well, I got really concerned about and by the way, you mentioned the kids who are 14 and seeing this. At some days, I just can't watch the news either. So I know. It's just so depressing. And there seemed to be like a week of news cycle where they were talking about inflamed hearts. So I got nervous because everybody on my father's side has heart disease, has a heart attack. So I went and I got a full workup, and I did a stress test. I did very well on my stress test, by the way.
Good. Congratulations.
I kicked ass. They didn't give me a lollipop or anything, but I kicked ass. And then they ultrasounded my lower legs for clots.
Yeah.
And nothing there. I got the echo and everything. So I didn't have that. And it's funny because my COVID doctor said early on, you know, you're going to start getting tests, as you should, and pretty much everything's going to come back normal, which is the problem. Like, you know, and I said, you know, this is the only time where I want some bad medical news. So at least I know what it is and we can treat it. You know,
it's so funny. I didn't tell you the story about my first couple of days with COVID when I got sick. And then I got a COVID test the next day. And I think we did one even the next day, and they were negative, negative. And I was like, oh shit. And I scheduled another one. That was on Christmas Eve. I scheduled another one for Monday, which was now 4 days into this thing. And on Sunday night, I'm lying in bed going, oh my God, I've got to have a positive test. What if it's negative? Oh, this is acute lymphocytic leukemia for sure. This is leukemia. I'm going to have a bone marrow biopsy in the morning. Get used to it. It's going to be okay. You know, I had a full. So the most distressing episode of this entire thing for me was the third night, heading into the fourth day, Friday, Saturday, fourth night, I guess. And I was lying in bed, just going, "I have leukemia. I know it. It's because I'm negative. I'm COVID. If this isn't COVID, what is it?" And that's why doctors should never take care of themselves.
I was going to say, too much knowledge is a bad thing. I'm not sophisticated enough to think that. But I had a couple of nights where I had trouble catching my breath.
Yeah,
and I hadn't had a lot of shortness of breath. And I was like, Thank God, because that's really that worried. I have had it on and off, but there was one night, and I was almost going to wake my wife Carol up and go, "I think you got to take," because I couldn't. You know, when you take that breath that it goes way down, and you really catch your breath. I couldn't get there, and I don't know what it was.
It's called air hunger. It's called air hunger.
Oh, is that what that is? Oh, speaking of hunger, I want to talk to you about what is your diet been like? What are you eating? Has it, because how has it affected your, appetite, your level of hunger?
So my sense of smell stayed intact the whole way. And they think the nose, the olfactory bulb damages through damaging of the blood vessels. And it makes sense to me that any other cranial nerve might also get it. I got it in my right ear. I have to think about whether this is right or left. Right ear. I got ringing in my ear. I've decreased hearing in my ear. My
tongue. You have ringing in your ear? You have? Horrible. Oh, I didn't get that.
Horrible. Beyond. Oh. And the more I do, the worse it gets. So right now it's just rough. The tongue was very weird. I could taste temperature, not spice, heat, temperature. So I craved coffee and tea and things like that. Oh. And everything tasted salty. Everything.
Wow.
Weird.
Mine was different. So I went to see an ear, nose, and throat guy, and he said, you know, there's two sets of, I think, nerve endings, and there's a secondary and a primary. And this gets generally the secondary, which is they grow back. If it gets the primary, then that's when you lose your sense of smell. So I couldn't smell or taste anything. Now I find if I get really tired, I lose my sense of taste.
Yes.
It seems to be tied to that. Right.
Yes, and I get a little bit of that too. I got it today that way. Yeah.
And then what happened was the first couple of weeks, especially, I was eating, you know, but then there would be moments like you think you feel hungry, but you don't feel like eating because you feel like you're nauseous and hungry at the same time. Have you had that?
Yeah. My appetite stayed good pretty much the whole way. Mm-hmm. And some of it may have been the steroids, right? Steroids can kind of stimulate your appetite. And, although I was hungry and eating a lot of high calorie things, I still don't think I ate as much as I normally do. I think generally I was down in just nutrition, but
did you crave carbs?
A little bit. I ended up eating ice cream at night. Yeah.
I was craving bread and I was trying to watch what I was eating, but then what was happening was I was going to bed. This is in the first couple of weeks, especially. And I'd wake up with a wicked headache. And I called my doctor and I'm like, and we figured out that I would eat at say 8 o'clock at night or 7 o'clock at night. I go to bed at midnight. The body was just getting hammered by this virus and getting ravaged and needed fuel. And so I went that whole night from 7 o'clock until 8 a.m. with no food. It was like the kind of headache I would get if I didn't eat, right? So I started to have to eat a bit just before I went to bed, which I never do, especially when I'm performing on the weekend. And it helped. Like I would wake up and I'd feel better, because that was the other thing the doctor said to me. They said, you need to eat every 3 or 4 hours and I was starting to go back to the gym. Don't go back to the gym. You need to keep your energy saved for what the system is doing. So she said, you can walk, but that's like 105 beats per minute. And like, that's like, that happens to me when I see meatballs and spaghetti,
right,
I get excited.
Right.
So that was nothing. So I started about a few weeks ago to start running again. And I actually, while I'm really tired at the end of the day, I'm not doing my normal workout, but I'm really tired at the end of the day, but I do feel a little more invigorated after I do it. And,
you know, I was doing very slow last week, 10 or 15 minutes on a treadmill, and that seemed to help.
Yeah.
Seemed to help. And I've not been doing it this weekend. I'm having a pretty lousy weekend.
Yeah. So can you just real quick before we jump, I know there's the immune system. I know there's inflammation. Is this about cells? Is this about nerve endings? Is that what's getting attacked? Is that why I'm getting random shooting pains? How do the nerve endings part of this play into this?
We don't know. We really don't know for sure, because there's three different things that can be happening. One is there's concern about the blood supply to the nerves, that there's these clusters of neutrophils that are interfering with blood supply, we think. Mm. There are inflammatory mediators like cytokine that may be affecting the function of nerves. And then there's concern that the virus gets in the nerve and might be leaving behind some sort of damage or some sort of something that we haven't identified yet. So yeah, so well, they're pointing at the cytokine system. That's where most of the energy is going. So that's the predominant wisdom. So yeah.
So for people who haven't gotten it, now that not just from a doctor's perspective, but someone who's had it and is now a rookie long hauler. I can't make you a full long hauler. You get a badge. You get through 1 month. You get a badge. You're in.
Clip on like the mat used to put on your shirt.
Yeah. Or like a gold star. I mean, what would you say to people from your perspective about this, in terms of what it, obviously we've been talking about what it's doing to you.
I would say get the vaccine if you possibly can. Don't even, if you're older and you're in a risk category, any potential risk of the vaccine is clearly worth it. It's worth it. We don't fully know all the risks, worth it as compared to this thing. That's A. B, worry more about the morbidity of this thing than the mortality. All this focus on the mortality is rare. I never worried about mortality with this thing. That's 1%. I mean, when a doctor tells you have a 1% risk, he's telling you, don't think about it. Don't worry about it. So mortality is 1%, but morbidity is like 20%. I mean, people get all kinds of misery and injury and long hauler syndrome. So B, think about the morbidity of this thing, not just the mortality if you're trying to assess your risk. And if you're older, take the vaccine. C, hit it hard and early. Work with it and use telemedicine. Your doctor doesn't even have to see you at the beginning. We know this syndrome so well. You can do it all through telephone or telemedicine. Right. So work with the communication systems. Hit it hard and early with your doctor. Then communicate with your doctor regularly when you start getting, if you get into the later phases like I did. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that monoclonal antibodies was a life changer. They kept me out of the hospital for sure.
Now,
the bamlanivimab is available. There's a sign-up sheet at HHS. Get it. Talk to your doctor about it. And then steroids may or may not be a good idea depending on what your doctor thinks.
See, I learned a lot today, but one of the things is this on the monoclonal antibodies, because I got the sense that was just for people, you know, that could afford it or that had certain exceptions or connected.
Okay. It's that's a government already bought it and can't distribute it. They can't get rid of it.
Well, I got this in June. Why didn't somebody tell me this in June? It was just June. Why didn't they say something?
I don't think it was available till like December. I think really started. Now Regeneron, which was a Trump guy, Regeneron is the same thing for in hospital. Okay. So when you go into the hospital, you get Regeneron, Remdesivir. They pretty much always use steroids there, sometimes antibiotics. So that's a different protocol than the outpatient setting.
What does Remdesivir do again?
That's antiviral. That kills, that prevents the virus from replicating. So that's the theory also on ivermectin. And there's, a lot of countries that use ivermectin.
I don't know if you had this early on, I was among my friends, I was pretty much the first person to get it. And you get a lot of what's it like? I'm like, I lost my testosterone, I'm tired. And then I had this one friend and he thought he was helping me. He goes, I know a guy who got it. He goes, he lost his sense of taste and smell. Still hasn't gotten it back. He's probably not going to get it back. I'm like, oh. And then, I swear to God. And then he said to me, he goes, this thing. They said, it can affect you in different ways. He goes, I know another guy. He had it. He went in. He was fine. He got cleared. Like 2 months later, he had a clot in his leg that had to take off his lower leg. I'm like, you're not helping me. Like, what are you doing?
Oh my God.
Know what? Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to have your wife and my wife can live together, and you and I can live together like two old men with blankets, and we could just sit and talk about our ailments together. How about that?
It's incredibly entertaining. I'm sure your podcast audience loves this.
I got crabs. You don't know. That's a terrible thing.
Oi.
All right, buddy.
The ringing in my ears.
Oh my God. And the thing, and this food is terrible. All right. I'm glad you're getting better. And I'll talk to you on the phone in a couple of days. This is Dr. Drew, obviously. And we hope we either helped you or depressed you. One of the two.
Yeah. I mean, I think what my hope is that I wish the public health departments were talking less about numbers of people that died and more about how to stay out of the hospital, where to get the vaccine, what treatments are available, how to talk to your doctor about these things. I really wish they would do more of that. And I do a stream most days at drdrew.com. You can find there where we talk to people.
Great.
I talk to experts and stuff.
Yeah. But you also take questions. It's great. People should check it out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell them where, again, drdrew.com.
Everything's at drdrew.com. Also, After Dark, which is more of an entertainment podcast. And That's with Tom Segura and his wife. And then and there's a bunch of other podcasts I do there. So you'll find them all at the web, doctordrew.com.
Mm-hmm. All right, buddy. Dr. Drew. Thanks, everybody.
All right, buddy.
There you go. Hope you didn't mind our complaining about our ailments like two cranky old people, but hope you got something from it. Don't forget, check out my YouTube channel, youtube.com/PaulMercurio, and subscribe there and tell your friends about the podcast and have them subscribe. Also, if they haven't, they're not part of the cool kid gang, man. I'm telling you, they're missing out. All right. See you next week, guys.